This is the Canadian Investor, where you take control of your own portfolio and gain the confidence you need to succeed in the markets. Hosted by Braden Dennis and Simon Bélanger.
Welcome back to the Canadian Investor Podcast. I'm here with Dan Kent. We're back for our regular Thursday episode. We will only have one news and earnings this week. I think it's a pretty good one. There's a lot of stuff that happened actually, in the last few days that'll be interesting to talk about. We're both feeling a little bit, I guess, sick to some extent. I'm coming out of that cold I've had for a few days or a week now. And Dan, you're battling Alberta allergies, huh?
Yeah, the wildfires in Fort McMurray are not good on me. I don't know what's worse, like heavy allergies or being sick, but if I sound a little bit stuffy, that's it. But yeah, I think it was a pretty slow week in the Canadian end, but there's still plenty of good U.S. stocks and some like kind of stocks today that are really kind of highlight the state of the economy, really. Even some of the financial stocks we'll go over and retailers, things like that. So it should be a pretty good episode.
Yeah, and I'm sure for most people, it's countdown to Canadian bank earnings. We're a couple of weeks out or 10 days or something.
End of May. That's right. Yeah, like they'll be the end of May.
Okay, so don't worry for those old Canadian banks. We will be talking about them. I know a lot of people are looking forward to that. Well, the first thing on the slate here, because we do have quite a bit, is the meme stocks that are making a comeback. So I was looking at this earlier this morning, ended up going into a bit of a rabbit hole. I thought it would take me like 20 minutes to do this segment, and then probably did an hour and 15 minutes worth of research to make sure I had some context around it. So for those who are not familiar, meme stocks, it happened, I think it was like 2021, if I remember correctly, early 2021, when that kind of all started. And the, I guess, poster child of the meme craze was GME. So GameStop, and as of Tuesday this morning, when we're recording as of 11:30 a.m., compared to the close on Friday, GME is up 199%. AMC, another meme stock, I guess it's following the GME trend here, up 228%. And our very own BlackBerry, that's doing nothing, but because people are, I think it's been caught up in all of this. So that one is up 26%. There's other names too. These are not the only ones. Now, I'll go over what exactly happened. So just to provide some context, and I do encourage people, there is a documentary on Netflix that went over the whole kind of meme stock GME craze. Can't really remember what the name is. I watched it maybe a year or two ago.
Was it Dumb Money or something, was it called?
Something like that. I'm not quite sure. Anyways, well, maybe you look that up while I continue here. Yeah. But essentially, Roaring Kitty, who's also known as Keith Gill, he's the guy behind the GameStop meme stock mania. He posted on X or Twitter for the first time since June 18, 2021. So he posted a picture of a drawing of someone sitting in a chair last Sunday, May 12th. And the picture appears to show someone that's relaxing back and then crouches forward with a gaming controller. So obviously, that is kind of up to interpretation. And for our joint TCI listeners, I am showing the tweet that I'm talking about. So this was his first tweet since essentially 3 years, not quite, but pretty close to it. And since then, there have been 14 more videos posted. That's how many I counted. And as I was counting, another one got posted. So there might be more by the time you listen to this. If you're not familiar with his videos, they're essentially short videos, typically like less than a minute and a half, and they're typically montages from scenes of different movies. Sometimes there's some music in the background, and it sends a message, and that's my interpretation of something coming up and gearing up for battle, obviously leaving room for interpretation, but that's the general sense I got from them. And where things get really, really messed up, in my opinion, and where I think regulators will be looking at this, is when you start looking at GameStop volume, which started going up significantly on May 3rd. To give people here some context, in the past year, the daily volume was just a few million shares, the average. Typically you'd see like 2, 3, 4, 5, definitely in the single digit millions. May sound like a lot, but that's the typical volume. And if you go back to a year, you'll see some days or were a few days where there might have been 10, 15, even sometimes 20 million shares, but it never lasted for more than a few days. And I think there was one instant when it went up to 60 million, but that was kind of a one-off. And on May 3rd, the volume jumped to 36 million. So if you look at that compared to the previous day, which was 8 million volume, which actually was quite higher than the day before that. So May 1st was 2.6 million, May 2nd, 8.6 million, and then May 3rd, you have a significant jump where you have 36 million in terms of volume, and then May 6th, 48 million, May 7th, 24 million. You have May 8th, close to 25 million, May 9th, close to 26 million, May 10th, so last Friday, 36.8 million, so let's just say 37 million. And then the tweet came out over the weekend, and then May 13th on Monday, 182 million of volume. And today, as of about an hour ago recording, the volume was 106 million. So I don't know about you then, but where there's smoke, there's often fire. Like, there's often a fire, not to, talk about the fires up north here, but something feels like quite fishy here. Like, the fact that you have this big tick up in volume, essentially like a week or so before the tweet comes out, and then the tweet comes out and the stock just literally explodes.
Yeah, it's pretty, you're talking like a 4x day over day volume increase, and then it keeps on trending up and it like stays elevated. So clearly like something's going on here. Some people like probably knew this was going to happen is what I would guess. Like, I mean, when you go from, you know, 2.8 million on April 30th to, well, today we're probably, it's got to close over 200 million today, probably. It's 1 p.m. Eastern and it's already at, you know, nearly 110. So it's probably going to close. You would think, you know, at 100 times, well, not quite 100 times, but like 80x the volume that it did a few weeks ago, something is fishy. It was it was dumb money.
Dumb money.
It was the movie. So it's, yeah, it's like, it's kind of like it's not a documentary, I would say. It's, I don't know, what are they called? Like
I
a mockumentary
so.
Type
yeah.
thing? I mean, it's like a comedy slash drama. I actually haven't seen it. I don't know if it's, is it any good?
Yeah, it's good. It's worth, I mean, it's entertaining. Like, even if you're, you know, you're watching it with your better half, I think, you know, she'd probably enjoy it. Like, it's not like, I mean,
yeah.
I think it's more like, I definitely think it's more in the documentary category. And I think it was pretty well done. After all this, I think I'll probably rewatch it this week, to be honest.
I'm definitely going to watch it now. Yeah. I had forgotten about this guy, to be honest. But yeah. It was like, I remember early 2021, it was just a gong show.
Yeah.
On all these stocks.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, at the end of the day, some people, I tweeted something out regarding this. Someone said like, oh, maybe his account got hacked. It's possible. I mean, it's just like, I cannot imagine just based on that. And we don't have all the information clearly, but just based on the volume and the timing of it, I cannot imagine that regulators will not be looking at this. Like, I 100% think, you know, they'll be looking at this, whether charges are laid or not. I guess that remains to be seen. And clearly with the video, I think the first thought that comes to mind is just plausible deniability, because they are not, you know, it leaves room to interpretation, like we said. So, and I think the other meme stocks are kind of just caught in the crossfire. So people are just like getting excited. And I guess the last thing I'll just mention here is, I've been feeling that the markets have been quite overvalued, to be honest, for probably some time. And it's hard not to think that they're overvalued when this kind of stuff happens, right? Like, it's people are, I don't know. Yeah, it's hard to explain, to be honest. I'm a bit lost for words. Yeah.
It definitely seems like frothy right now. And then you see something like this, which is like the last time this occurred was during the bonkers markets of 2021, which were, I mean, they ended pretty poorly, you know, later on in that year for a lot of these types of stocks. But it's going to be interesting to see, because he's still posting videos. Like, he posted one just 15 minutes ago. So, I mean, he's made like, it looks, yeah, like you said, like 10 or 14 videos today. So I'm sure this is only the beginning.
Yeah.
of, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, it's hard to say. I mean, I've watched, like, I basically, to prepare for that, I watched, like, all the ones that were posted just to see if I could find a theme. And that's what I mentioned was kind of the general impression I got. But I'm sure we will probably have to touch back on it next week because it's hard to think that there any developments on that. Now, just kind of going into a bit of the macro picture, Canada's job report comes in stronger than expected. So the headline number was 90,000, definitely stronger than expected for April. And it's important to put in context because of those 90,000 jobs, 50,000 of these jobs were actually part-time. Not incredibly surprising. I think that lines a lot with university and college students, right? They finish university and oftentimes they'll start kind of picking up more hours and work part-time. On the provincial and percentage basis, New Brunswick saw the biggest uptick with 2% increase in April. BC, Quebec, and Ontario saw respective growth of 0.8%, 0.4%, and 0.3%. The employment and unemployment rates were unchanged following the strong job report. And the fact that it was unchanged is because the participation rate increased 0.1%. So it kind of offset that. And that means the number of people that are age 15 or and older looking for work or employed. So that's what the participation age is. And the main areas of job growth were professional, scientific, and technical services, accommodation, and food services, healthcare, and social assistant. And then there are some other areas, but those were the three main with over 15,000 each for those sector. And, you know, I think also it's important for people to remember that it's could very well be that these numbers are revised down the line. And that's always a thing that people have to keep in mind is especially these job numbers. And the U.S. is like really infamous for that, right? Is there's revisions down the line. I've been digging through those stats, especially in the U.S., just because there's just so much more available to a granular level. I mean, I know stats can tries to do the best job they can, and I'm sure it's a hard job, but you just have so much more data in the U.S., whether it's the Bureau of Labor Statistics or each of the feds have kind of areas that they focus on. So it's just a lot of stuff to draw on. And apparently some of the job numbers are, when they come out, they're kind of part of it are like estimations. So that's why, you know, they get revised down the line. So I always find that interesting. Anything you want to add here before I go on, Dan?
No, I mean, the one thing I guess that's a little alarming, but it might just be coming from me because I'm in Alberta and like our housing market is just exploding, but like the decline in construction jobs.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you like with how desperate we need like new housing construction and all that type of stuff, I mean, it's pretty just surprising to see the large drawdown. And then I even believe like out of those 90, so I think 50,000 were part-time and I think almost 30,000 were public sector or something. I can't remember that exact number, but there was a lot of part-time jobs and government jobs as well. So, I mean, yeah, it kind of paints to a picture like that, you know, rate cuts. Does it really need to happen in June now? I mean, maybe they start talking about that. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a great point because whether the numbers are great or not, when you start digging into it, it doesn't really matter if they need a reason to not cut. So people may say, oh, like, okay, if you start digging into the numbers, it's really not good. But, you know, the reality is whether it's in Canada or the U.S. or any other central bank, if they can point to the headline number and say, well, look, jobs are growing, 90,000 new jobs in April. If they can point to that, it's kind of an easy excuse to not cut rates. You know, same thing for the U.S. So I think that's a really good point, to be honest. And I think, you know, Tiff McLean, of course, that a rate cut was a possibility at the June meeting. Obviously, all the headlines had like that in bold, like, you know,
yeah,
bolded, and that was kind of the thing that was being said after that meeting. But people kind of forget that a possibility is not, you know, a guarantee. And I always find it funny because, you know, you'll have news outlet that will kind of anchor on that one word. But I do remember that meeting, and I remember that the way they were talking, they left themselves ample room to not cut if they saw that as the best possible outcome. So I think it's important to remember that. And with the strong headline employment numbers, again, like, it just gives them a bit more ammunition to that. So the probabilities of rate cut in the US have steadily been pushed out. We've been talking about that. And it may be harder now for the BOC to start cutting. And even today, I think Powell came out and said that inflation was actually more stubborn than they thought it would be. And that the rates would probably stay elevated for longer. So it's just, I think, a good reminder for people that I think you have to be careful when, you know, you make investment decisions, especially, you know, we've been harping on BCE a whole lot, but BCE is not alone in terms of companies that I've seen their interest expense go way, way up. They're not the only company that has a lot of debt on the balance sheet that will need to refinance part of it in the coming years. And higher rates clearly will make that refinancing of debt more expensive. And to me, it's just a reminder for people, you know, it's fine to invest if you think it's a good investment to invest in companies with a significant amount of debt, but make sure you draw different outcomes, because if the only thesis is that, or your thesis is heavily reliant on rate cuts, well, what if they don't happen in the time frame that you think? Or what if they happen, but not to the extent that that you think in your premise and so in your thesis? So I think that's really important for people to remember, because unfortunately, the tweets I've seen with people that are really bullish on BCE, a lot of it has been anchored on those rate cuts. And now those tweet looks, they look like they aged like milk. So
Yeah. I mean, even if you sit here like at last year, say at this point, most people figured there would already be cuts, or at least, like, you know, they might be starting in May or June.
Most predictions were like March would become basically the latest they would start.
And it's like a lot of these people predicting these cuts are, you know, very smart economists, and even they don't get it right. So, I mean, that is the case. Like, you shouldn't really make investments based on policy rates, because absolutely nobody knows where they're going to go. Because if I were to have guessed last year, I would say at this point they would have started cutting by now. But well, remember our bold predictions from the start of the year.
I thought, like, we were wrong. I called it.
That's already dead in the water. Yeah, that is already not happening. Unless something like material really happens.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I don't want my bold prediction to be right at this point, even if I would probably benefit when I refinance my mortgage, just because I think if it does happen, like you said, we're probably going to be in a world of hurt.
Yeah, there's going to be a big shock, because I think I predicted 200 or 250 basis points. And for that to happen by year's end, there would be a material shock to the system. Something really bad would have had to happen.
No, exactly. But I think that's enough for the job numbers here. So you want to talk to us about GoEasy earnings?
Yeah, so GoEasy is just, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of it. It's an alternative lender in here in Canada. It's like exploded over the last 20 some years. They topped estimates on both revenue and earnings. It's pretty clear that, I mean, GoEasy is benefiting from a weaker economy and rising cost of living, which ultimately leads to more Canadians needing to borrow from alternative lenders. I mean, if you think about it, most of the people who are going for financing through a company like GoEasy would typically be rejected by, you know, an institution prior to going to GoEasy, like a major bank maybe won't lend to them or something like that. So typically they go to these alternative lenders. This is the 56th straight quarter of positive same-store sales growth. So you're going to 14-plus consecutive years this company has grown same-store sales. Year-over-year revenue grew by 28%. New customer volumes are up by 17%. Operating income is up by 30%. Earnings per share of $3.40 is up 13% on a year-over-year basis. And this is actually despite regulators. So I can't remember. It was at some point last year, but they essentially reduced the APR, like the interest rate you can charge on the loans. I can't even remember what it was at before. It was over 40 and they reduced it down to 35%. So at first, many people believed this would kind of hit go easy quite a bit, but the company pretty much came out and said like it wouldn't really be impacted all that much. And in the latest quarter, the company's weighted average interest rate on its loan sits at 30%, which is actually down 0.2% on a year-over-year basis. And I would imagine this is just due to the company needing to restructure some of the loans that did sit above that regulation. So it's going to drag down their average interest rate. And the company has two core segments. It has its Easy Home and Easy Financial. So the financial end is obviously loans, but its Easy Home segment is where people go to lease everything from furniture to electronics. The part of this business is seeing a pretty significant decline in growth. And I don't really mean a decline as in sales are dropping. They're just not really growing at the rate they used to be. I mean, they used to grow quite a bit pre-policy rate hike, and now they're only growing at 2% year over year. I went on to this website. This was like 3-4 years ago, and I remember seeing a PlayStation that you could buy on Easy Home. And I can't even, I'd have to run the numbers, but I think it was like $20 a month for like 120 months that you pay for this thing. And I worked out the actual cost and I'm like, this is absolutely insane. You're going to pay over $2,000 for this $600 PlayStation and like furniture, electronics, anything you could think of, that segment of the business sold it. And I just kind of thought like, who is doing this? But clearly a lot of people are. Now, not so much because, you know, it's probably an easy expense to cut out. You don't want to finance a couch over 10 years.
Well, I would also over 10 years. Think that buy now, pay later is eating into those as well, right? Because it's so easy.
Yeah, because those are often...
Yeah, it's right at
interest
checkout.
Interest rate free too.
Exactly, interest rate out. And sure, it's not going to be $20 a month for a PlayStation, but let's say $150 for 4 months. A lot of people I feel like will probably be like, I can make it work, like $150. Yeah. So I would think buy now, pay later definitely would be a big competition for them.
Yeah. And I would say if you have to finance a PlayStation at $20 a month for 10 years, you probably shouldn't be buying one.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I would agree with that.
It only makes up, it's a pretty small portion of GoEasy's revenue. I think it's around 10%. So I'm pretty sure they're at like $366 million on the quarter, and the Easy Home is like $30 million, maybe a bit more. Net charge-off rates came in at 9.1%. This would be loans unpaid. It's in line with the company's target ranges and is actually below pre-pandemic levels still. So a lot of the issues that people projected with these alt lenders is, you know, times would get tough, default rates would rise, but they're like, this is still a relatively high charge-off rate. Like it is high, but they are like, they're an alternative lender. I mean, they have quite a few people who are probably in tough shape financially coming in and getting loans. And I mean, especially now, like the weaker the economy gets, I believe the more popular a platform like GoEasy becomes. So they like record loan volumes and new applications for credit, 41%. So they're seeing a 41% increase in applications for credit, which is just, it's insane. Return on equity, 24.6%. So it's like, it's probably 1,000 basis points higher than most of the major banks. Like it's, it's a pretty crazy business. I mean, again, like GoEasy aside, when we look to these earnings, it kind of paints a picture of the state of the Canadian consumer. It's a place you go when you're rejected from another financial institution because the interest rates at these institutions are just, I mean, they're horrible. A lot of people see it as like predatory lending, like borderline predatory lending.
I would say I would qualify it subprime. That's essentially what it is.
Yeah.
Right? It's subprime.
Yeah, they're a subprime lender. Yeah.
And those will do well as long as the economy is doing well.
Yeah.
But I would say this is probably, it's probably entering the riskiest phase of for like cyclicality for this company, because people may like be tempted and, you know, maybe it'll be a good investment. I'm not saying that, but, you know, it's just cyclicality, right? As You have people that are really not in the best financial situation going that they probably have a job. That's how they're being able to get approved. But if the economy takes somewhat of a downturn and you start seeing layoffs tick up, that's where the write-offs could really start going way, way up for for a subprime lender.
Yeah, and it's... I mean, I don't really think it's unique to Canadians either, because there's a pretty popular Canadian company as of late. It's called Propel Holdings. So it trades, I think its ticker is PRL, but it's gone up. I think it's gone up so much. I think it's gone from like $10 a share to like $26 a share in pretty short order. And they're like more US focused and they're seeing huge activity as well. So, I mean, there's definitely a flood of consumers that are going to these, you know, B-grade subprime like alternative lenders.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's good for shareholders right now for sure, but I mean, it's not really a good look in terms of consumer financial health. But that being said, like GoEasy's been around for quite a while. I think they've been publicly traded since the 90s. So they've gone through, you know, quite a bit of different environments. They've typically come out unscathed. We'll see how it goes at this point in time, but I was just shocked by, you know, the new applications for credit, the loan originations, like how much they're dishing out right now, especially like when Canadians are supposed to be scaling back a bit, you know, not borrowing as much. That's essentially the objective of higher policy rates. But these lenders are not seeing any type of slowdown right now.
Yeah, exactly. And just showing the chart just to show people, like, you can clearly tell, like, exactly what I'm saying, right? So it's very cyclical. And this is the kind of company, like, over time, it's performed very well. I'm not going to deny that. But you can see that once you get into these economic cycle and the economy slows down or we go into recession, the results go follow, right? So it's kind of, it kind of goes on the way up. I mean, it's pretty clear, right? It goes on the way up as things are going well. And then I would be willing to bet that, you know, if we get into a recession or there's a significant downturn, those results will start being hit just because, you know, people start losing their job and they can't service those loans. And chances are, is if they're getting these loans, they're already getting stretched, and it's not surprising. I mean, we've talked about it before. People can look it up. The feds in the US, the different feds, like I've said earlier in the show, they will focus on different kind of economic data, but I can't remember which one, but I think it's the New York Fed that does like a household indebtedness survey, and the credit card data in the US, and I imagine it's the same in Canada. I mean, we've seen it with certain businesses, is not looking great. People are fueling their spending with credit and not cheap credit. And at some point, the party stops, right? The music stops. Yeah. It's like musical chair. And I feel like there's about 5 chairs and 10 people. And once the music stops, there's going to be a lot of people left without a chair. You know, I don't mean to make light of this, but it's just the reality. I mean, credit is great while it's ongoing. I mean, we saw it in 2008, right? And the US was doing 2006, 2007, everything was great. Credit was fueling this housing bubble. All these other people were spending because they had equity and so on. And then when the music stops, bad things happen, unfortunately.
Yeah, and these are, like, this loans through a company like GoEasy are typically going to be at higher APRs than even a credit card. So, I mean, a lot of these loans are, again, like, a lot of people feel this is, like, borderline predatory lending, like, just 30% plus APRs, which are, like, crippling financially. Like, it's almost impossible to get out of that, especially if you're stretched to the point where you're going to GoEasy because you have no other option elsewhere. Like, it's a pretty tough, you know, a lot of people don't invest in them just because of this type of situation. But I mean, it's posting good results right now. We'll see how it does moving forward.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. So let's move on. You're going to go over Stella Jones earnings. Haven't looked at this company in quite some time. So
I know it's an interesting company. Like they went through like a 7-year period. I believe it was like 2015 to 2022. Pretty much doing nothing. Like, it just returned next to nothing. And that was even with, you know, dividends reinvested. But I mean, it's absolutely exploded as of late. It's been one of the better performing Canadian stocks over the last years. because of its low residential lumber exposure, and I think Stella Jones, like, it's labeled as a lumber company, but it actually has very little residential lumber exposure compared to, you know, its entire business. But because of this low residential lumber exposure, when lumber skyrocketed during the pandemic and, you know, house building, residential, like house sales, all that type of stuff, they didn't really see the big run up in price like, you know, say a West Fraser Timber did because of that. But the gap has certainly closed. So since Stella's low point in 2022, it returned more than 158%, while a company like West Fraser is just 8%. So they reported earnings that topped expectations in a pretty big way. So earnings per share came in 26% higher than estimates, and EBITDA came in around 20% higher. So again, like surface level, they may just like look like a typical lumber stock, but it has a lot of products that kind of shelter it from the cyclical nature of the lumber industry. So I believe they're around 20% exposure to residential lumber, but their bread and butter is things like utility poles and railroad ties. So these are products that, you know, they're typically needed regardless of the state of the economy. I mean, there's going to be more infrastructure expansion, no doubt. Like when the economy is doing well, you know, they're going to need more ties, more utility poles during good economic times. But even in a weak economy, I mean, they're constantly replacing existing utility poles, existing railroad ties, just as a maintenance thing. So sales do tend to be relatively stable. They reported 9% sales growth. I mean, pretty much all due to the increased sales of its infrastructure-related products. Residential lumber sales actually declined on a year-over-year basis. And I mean, it's not surprising. I mean, even during that job report, construction was the biggest net loss of jobs. So that's definitely slowing down. Profit margins increased by 300 basis points. Operating margins by 260 basis points. So, you know, when you have margin expansion combined with, you know, the increased demand, it resulted in a 32% year-over-year increase in earnings per share. They had 16% organic growth in railroad ties, 7% in utility poles, and 8% in pressure-treated lumber. And then again, on the flip side, residential lumber, 3% decline in organic growth. But residential lumber only accounted for around 11% of the company's total sales on the quarter, whereas typically it's in the 20% range. And they issued guidance. It plans to grow its infrastructure segment by 9% annually. It aims to have it make up, again, around 75-80% of sales, with residential lumber picking up most of the remaining 20%, and it plans to grow EBITDA by around 9% through the end of 2025. So it's had a couple, like, really, really strong years. I mean, 32% earnings growth on, you know, single-digit revenue growth. Big margin expansion. It's, you know, it's killing it over the last few years.
Yeah, no, that's definitely, it's not the sexiest company, but I like the fact that there's a lot of it. Most of its revenues are kind of tied for industrial uses, right? So I think it just gives them a bit more stability. Their margins must vary with the costs and, you know, the price of,
for sure,
of lumber, right? And I'm assuming they must have some kind of agreements that, or maybe not, I don't know, with the big railway companies where maybe there's kind of inflation adjusted or a premium based, like almost a gas surcharge, right? How, you know, Air Canada, CN Rail, CP kind of charge. Maybe they have like a lumber surcharge. I don't know if that's anything like that.
They might. I mean, it's the one main thing that I would say is like on the bearer side of things is like, will they get away from using wood ties?
Yeah.
For, like, I don't know exactly what they replace them with, but I mean, something that's longer lasting, because you got to think, like, I bet you those ties get absolutely beat down. Like, there's probably so much maintenance on that end of things. Like, if they could find an alternative, it would obviously have a big impact on Stella. Like, I don't really imagine that's coming anytime soon, but it's probably something that's being investigated for sure. Cause, yeah, the maintenance on those wooden ties would be crazy.
Yeah, I would imagine. I mean, I think it's something we'll probably have to dig into. It's pretty interesting just to see that. But no, I think looks like an interesting company, definitely, a company that we probably should talk a bit more on this podcast for sure.
Yeah, it's had a few good years. I figure I'd bring it up because probably, not a lot of people look at it. Not a lot of people probably even know that it exists. But yeah, they're There's actually a plant very close to my house where they make, well, probably like a 15-minute drive. And same thing, it's pretty much all utility poles that they make there. It's a pretty crazy operation.
Oh, that's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Well, anything else on Stella, or we'll go to, I guess, more of bellwether stocks for the economy now?
Nope, that's it.
Okay, so well, the next one on the slate is Canadian Tire, so nothing gets more Canadian than this, I guess, for on the retail side. Was really not great in terms of results for Canadian Tire. Not surprising. I mean, the stock was a bit up on the day, but I think it's probably more of a reflection of people just expecting maybe even worse. Not quite sure, but as joint TCI listeners can see, so you can see the quarter of last year. This is just a total revenues, and you know, it's not been great essentially for the past year. Canadian Tire has definitely been struggling, so revenues came in lower at 4.9% on the year-over-year basis, and you have retail sales that were down 2.1%. Canadian Tire brand revenue was down 6.9%. Sport Chek was the worst of their brand. It was down 7.9%. Mark's Warehouse was down 2%. Helly Hansen down 7.8%. And gas revenue was down 2.8%. So I could have made this shorter and just say it was down across the board, but I wanted to show the differences between all of it. It's, you know, it was to be expected, I think, with Canadian Tire. Net income was up 83% to $122 million due to lower SG&A expenses. Earnings per share was up almost 10x to $1.38. Now, I would take this with a grain of salt since last year's results were impacted by a fire at one of their main distribution centers. So clearly, this year will look better, but they have made progress, at least on the expense front. Now, where it gets interesting, at least from my perspective, is when you start digging into the financial services segment, and they also have a real estate segment, but you know, I just have more interest, and I think it's a good barometer for what's kind of happening for the economy here. And that financial services segment is important because they have a large credit card business, as most people who have been listening to this podcast for a little bit probably are aware of. And this gives them insight as to how Canadians are spending. Now, credit card sales declined 0.6% compared to an increase of 6.1% the year before. Gross average accounts receivable, so GAAR, which is the amount that is owed on those credit card, was up 4.5%. So it kind of goes to what we were talking about here with GoEasy, where the balances are going up on credit cards, and accounts with a balance grew 0.6%. So that's basically people that are carrying a balance month to month. Net credit card write-off rate increased 110 basis points to 6.4%. It was up 30 basis points from the previous quarter. So the 6.4 is on a year-to-year basis. Clearly, this has been creeping up over the quarters. Past due credit card receivable increased 50 basis points to 3.6%, and that's unchanged from the previous quarter. And these are all things I think it's important to keep in mind, because I think it does paint a pretty good picture on what the consumer is doing. And clearly, I think a lot of people right now are using debt to make ends meet. You're seeing it all over the place. It's just credit card debt is going up, and GoEasy is doing well. That's an alternative lender, but you're seeing that in the US as well. So I don't know if you had anything else to add there.
No, I mean, it's not really surprising to see like Sport Chek being down that much. Like, they're pretty much all discretionary. I don't know if there's any necessities you need to buy at Sport Chek. And I mean, it's already ridiculously expensive in there.
Well, like, we're Canadian, so hockey sticks, hockey skates.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. But even then, like, it's so expensive there. I mean, even when I used to play hockey, like, but it's, I wouldn't go to Sport Chek. I would go to, like, a more, like, niche hockey place that we had in Calgary here. Just because Sport Chek was so expensive. I mean, even Canadian Tire, like, that, I'm actually surprised to see Canadian Tire down that much, because I mean, they do a lot of like automotive stuff. They have a lot of like, I mean, I guess they do a lot of seasonal stuff that people are probably also, you know, trimming down on. But I mean, it's not really, the numbers aren't really that surprising at all. this, I think we've covered them every quarter, and every single quarter that charge-off rate and the receivables unpaid like continues to tick up every single quarter. Whereas, like, surprisingly enough, a company like GoEasy has kept the charge-off rate relatively stable over the last few years. So it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think it's important, something to keep in mind of, if, especially for those investing. And it's not only Canadian Tire, right? If you're investing in any kind of consumer good business, especially discretionary consumer goods, something to keep in mind, because if it's discretionary, I mean, people at some point, if they have to make hard choices, that might be spending that they actually cut. Maybe now they're still spending there because they can use credit to do so, but credit is not infinite. At some point, you know, you're not going to be able to get credit wherever you go, right? So companies will just say, like, no, we're not lending you any more money. You already have enough debt. We're not sure if you'd repay it. If we, you lend, you know, we lend you an even more. So I think it's just a good reminder for people to understand that, you know, it's hard to say, I think, especially with credit card. If you have a company like Apple, right? I'm sure a decent amount of their iPhones are sold on credit, but who knows on to what extent. So it's really hard to say, because oftentimes, you know, you can buy an iPhone with your credit card, and the only thing that Apple sees is just you paid for it. They're not, you know, the loan is not with Apple, it's with a bank, right? So you don't really see that. But just something to keep in mind for discretionary spending, especially as people are getting more stretched, you know. I'll say it again, you know, at some point the music stops, right? If you can keep your level of spending, but, you know, if you just, you use credit at some point, you won't be able to. And I don't know about you, like, kind of a personal anecdote, but I see people, like, sometimes people I know and, you know, people out and about, and, you know, I think my wife and I have, like, a pretty good household income, but we're not, you know, we're definitely not in the top 1%. And I mean, we've been cutting back on some things, and I just see people spend, and I'm like, my God, I guess everyone's richer than us. Like, I just don't understand. Like, it's just, the only answer is people are in debt and they just keep, like, delaying the inevitable, and they're just, you know, they just keep spending and extend and pretend until you can no longer extend anymore. I just don't know. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I mean, people living off, you know, finance money pretty much. And it's not like you could rack up a credit card and, you know, the minimum payments are really not that much. You could live off something like that for quite some time, especially if you even have, you know, something like a line of credit where typically sometimes it's only the interest that's due. So times get tougher. I mean, people continue to live the same way. They don't have the money to do it. And then it eventually just, it comes back to haunt people after a while, because eventually it does need to be repaid. And I mean, we're clearly seeing it right now with, you know, the alt lending growing, the credit cards growing, all that type of stuff. It's not a good situation. Eventually the music does stop, or they could navigate themselves out of this to the point where, you know, it doesn't really get that bad, but there is a possibility that it could get that bad.
Yeah. Or, I mean, government bailout, right? Why not bail out your own citizen? I mean, the U.S., you've seen it in the U.S., like, people are, you know, I think it's a lot of people, it's contentious, right? Whether you agree with it or not, but student loans.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, I know, like, I have family that have some pretty steep student loans, and I know they can be quite burdensome, but when you think about it, okay, it's great, but what about the person who worked their butt off and didn't spend at all so they can try and pay off that loan as quickly as possible, and then they see their neighbor that just took on more debt, didn't pay it off, and then they get it forgiven? But I don't know, I was just kind of throwing that out there just as maybe a non-zero possibility.
Yeah, there's a lot of the student loan thing is quite controversial. I don't know. Don't really want to get into that too much on but
no,
do you want
I'm
to
just,
move on to Home Depot?
Yeah, yeah, okay. Oh. Dan doesn't want to get political. It's all good. It's more like I was trying to show both sides, right? Like, because sometimes people kind of think it's just good or just bad. And I think there's always, you know, most things, there's kind of
benefits
two sides.
To both sides.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So do you want to tell us about another bellwether stock? So Home Depot?
Yeah. Yeah, a big bellwether stock for, you know, U.S. consumers primarily, but they do have exposure in in both countries. So they delivered earnings that were relatively in line. I mean, nobody really expects Home Depot to perform well right now. The expectations are to kind of just tread water until the economy improves, people start spending more. So I own Home Depot. It's actually, outside of my crypto exposure, it's my largest position. So I believe, you know, the tailwinds that will be provided by Canadian and U.S. housing markets moving forward should allow it to continue to grow for a very long time. I mean, particularly in the U.S. market, where a lot of residents have, you know, rock bottom pandemic mortgages, which, you know, at that point, you're really incentivized. You know, if you sell your house and move, you're going to lose that rate, where, you know, if you spend some money to renovate, you might be able to keep that rate, because again, their mortgage structure is very, very different than ours. I mean, you can get that rate, you can keep it for the entirety of the mortgage, whereas, you know, here you have to refinance.
One of the big differences, though, on top of that, it's not portable. So a lot of Canadian mortgages are portable. So if you have, like, you know, you were one of those rock stars that got like a 10-year fixed mortgage, which are pretty rare, but you got them at like, you know, 2% at the lows, you can actually buy, depending on your mortgage, but in a lot of cases, you can buy a home and port your mortgage onto the new home, where in the US, that's typically not something you'd be able to do.
I think there is a few of them that are able to, but it's like few and far between. So, I mean, you have to think, if you're sitting there with like a 30-year fixed rate at, you know, 1.8% and you don't like your kitchen, like, are you going to sell that house and go somewhere else? Or are you going to be like, all right, let's just gut it and redo it the way we want?
HGTV it, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you think of the, because what are U.S. rates at right now? They got to be like over 6%. So like that is
more
a
than
huge
that. Yeah,
increase.
I think they're hovering around 7. Yeah.
Yeah, so mortgage. I mean, that's like, that's huge. So I think a lot of people are going to be incentivized right now, but, like, you know, right now is probably not a good time for anybody to do renovations. They're obviously, with the Home Depot's results, they're slowing down quite a bit. But they, so sales are down 2.3% and earning 7%. The company said results were impacted by the fact there was a late start to the spring. So, I mean, spring typically brings on a lot of new projects, whether it be yard work, deck, new shed. I mean, I just redid my entire, well, not redid, but just did my entire front lawn this weekend. I couldn't walk for like a day afterwards because we only had like, I should have went to Home Depot and bought like a full length shovel. But we only had like the little sod or just seeds.
Yeah.
No rock.
Oh,
we rocked our whole front. Yeah. So I'm wheelbarrow and rock, and I'm have to bend over like 90 degrees to get this shovel to put it into the barrel. It was, I should have invested in a good shovel. Should have went to Home Depot and helped them out. But yeah, I mean, spring is like huge with renovation projects. So obviously, if they did feel that it was a late start, it's probably going to impact results. If we look to same store sales, they fell 2.8% company wide, 3.2% in the United States. As I mentioned before, the difference between total sales and same store sales would be the company will isolate and leave out new store revenue, like new openings, to give a better picture on how it's growing without the need to add new stores. A couple of weeks ago, I talked about Starbucks and their average ticket per customer dipping and how this is kind of an indication of people scaling back a bit on spending, maybe opting for cheaper alternatives. Home Depot seeing the same thing. It's not as amplified as Starbucks. I think they were like 4% decline in average ticket, but it did report average decline of 1.3%. So this kind of leads me to believe that people are putting off larger projects. I mean, especially ones that need to be financed and are instead waiting for probably a better opportunity to pull the trigger on that, or, you know, waiting for some cash. They confirmed their 2024 guidance, in which they expect earnings and revenue to grow by only 1%. But this is actually due to the fact the company has an extra reporting week in 2024. So it said it's going to add around $2.3 billion in revenue and 30 cents per share during this week. If we factor that out, pretty safe to say they're going to see declines in 2024 relative to 2023. They plan to add around 12 new stores, and total interest expenses will come in at $1.8 billion. So financing expenses have gone from $1.3 billion in 2022 to $1.8 billion in 2024. And this is, you know, kind of highlighting how even a company with, you know, pretty rock solid balance sheet debt structure, I mean, I think Home Depot has around $44 billion in debt, but the thing is they generate, I think, almost $20 billion in free cash flow. So, I mean, the debt is not huge relative to the cash they generate, but you're still seeing like more than a 40% increase in financing costs since, you know, rates started elevating. So, I mean, it pretty much hits most all companies at this point. But yeah, it wasn't like a bad quarter relative to what was expected for Home Depot, but it's definitely like they're clearly feeling it from a softer consumer for sure.
Yeah, and just to show people what it looks like for free cash flow. So definitely, you know, they're generating the last few years in excess of like $10 billion a year in terms of free cash flow. So like you said, they definitely have the room to pay a dividend. And if they wanted to, they can definitely pay down that debt. But I think it's just a good reminder. I think Home Depot is a good example of a company that can do fine with higher rates. Yeah. If rates were lower, it probably would do even better. And that's the kind of company for me. It's okay. Like your thesis is not reliant on rates going down. It more likely would just be a boost to the business. And I think that's the point I wanted to make earlier is, you know, it's still, you know, going to be a great business. I mean, they're probably going to be fine even if rates go up 100 basis points from here. I'm not saying they will. I think it's, who knows whether they go up or just stay or go down. We'll see. But I think Home Depot is a great example of that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they're definitely going to see slower sales when rates are this high. But yeah, even if they were to stay elevated for long, I think they would see a return eventually of activity. And then, you know, when they go down, people, you know, they're tightening up right now. But they're eventually going to get back to spending, especially in terms of like any sort of projects, renovations, lawn projects, anything you can think of. And like in Canada, even Canada and the United States, I mean, they have way more like hardware stores down there, but I mean, it's either Lowe's or Home Depot here for the most part. I think we have Rona as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, we have Rona. Yeah, they bought the assets from Lowe's when Lowe's exited from Canada. But yeah, and I think you're right. At the end of the day too, even if rates stay higher for longer, there's just so many things that you can push back for maintenance, right? There's certain things you just have to do, right? If your refrigerator breaks, I mean, there's a few different places you can get a new refrigerator, but you're going to have to get one. You don't have a choice, right? And there's certain things, obviously, you'll push back. And I think that's probably why there's a little bit of softness in the results, is people are kind of pushing that back and waiting until either rates are lower or maybe they have a bit more money to spend and, you know, kind of the rate of inflation slows down and their salary catches up, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there's also the element that like new home builds, like, a lot of people don't think of Home Depot as like where you would go to buy, you know, a lumber for a new home construction, but they do deal with plenty of contractors in terms of new homes. So it's not just renovations, which are fueling their results. But I mean, they're kind of like a Walmart, I guess I would say. They have a big advantage over, you know, smaller department stores in this part because they're just like a high volume. They can just generate so much cash flow just by pushing through high volume. So prices generally get lower, you know, it's more favorable to shop there. And I think they're in a pretty good position, even though like how weak it is right now. I think they've got a pretty good, you know, it should be pretty good for them moving forward once things tame down a bit here.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I own it as well. It's a small position for me, definitely smaller. But I think that kind of wraps it up for today. I had Shopify I wanted to talk about, but, you know, the roaring kitty came roaring. So that kind of...
I had to talk about it.
Yeah, I had to talk about that. So we'll keep Shopify for next week. You know, I know there's a lot of people that listen that own the stock. I own it. It's a relatively small position for me. So I'll go over why, you know, the stock kind of had a big drop once earnings were released. And I think Shopify is starting to become a little bit of a bellwether stock in its own way, right? Because you really see kind of smaller businesses that use their online e-commerce platforms. So a company like Shopify that may be, you know, slowing down the growth a little bit, maybe an indicator that, you know, things are slowing down for the economy as well. But we'll touch more on that next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you haven't done so, if you can just take a few minutes, give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, whichever platform you listen to us on. You can find me on @X/Twitter, @Fiat_Iceberg, Dan @StockTrades_CA. Still got that
That's
one?
That's it, yep.
Yeah, perfect. Yep. And StockTrades.ca if you're looking to see Dan's work there as well. And yeah, we'll see you guys next week.
The Canadian Investor Podcast should not be construed as investment or financial advice. The hosts and guests featured may own securities or assets discussed on this podcast. Always do your own due diligence or consult with a financial professional before making any financial or investment decisions.